This is Brass Tactics, policy and strategy for the people, not the politics.
Welcome back to Brass Tactics after our little 2-week hiatus. Apologies for dropping off the net on everybody, but I'm going to go ahead and blame Pete. It's always Pete's fault. Isn't that right, Pete?
Not in this case. Didn't you literally have a kid?
But no, in all seriousness, my wife and I just welcomed our newest family member at the end of March, and so we had to step away for a little bit to get our chaotic house in order for a little bit, and now we are back, and we are probably downshifting to every other week, just because not enough spicy stuff happens in the news to keep up the weekly tempo.
So, yeah, the world's so boring right now.
You know, it's like, you just lather, rinse, repeat, though, you know? Like, how many more times can I say realism is a garbage paradigm before people stop hearing it? Speaking of realism.
Yes. Power politics at work?
I heard something real in Israelism happened. That's a terrible segue. But, you know, so probably going to go to every other week, and then we'll reassess from there once all that good sponsorship money we don't have because we don't have sponsors kicks in. Maybe we'll find some time and space to up the ante again.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, well, I think today, I think the current events we're covering, the Iran revenge strike, I think that falls more into a posturing category, is how I see it.
So what happened, Joe, for those of our listeners who aren't glued to Twitter and Telegram like we are? What exactly went down on Saturday to Sunday night last?
Well, according to our State Department, we assisted in knocking more than 300 bad guy drone stuffs out of Israel airspace.
Mm-hmm.
That was fired directly by Iran and Iranian proxies.
Mm-hmm. I believe count came to about 185 drones, 100 ballistic missiles, and then about, I think, 30 or so cruise missiles.
Yeah, 30 cruise missiles, 150 UAVs, and 110-ish medium-range ballistics.
Yes, which are expensive, by the way. The medium-range ballistic missiles that Iran has, those are their most expensive, and it's their scarcest, because they have a lot more shorter-range ballistic missiles that really can't get beyond central Iraq. So it's a significant commitment, 110 of those things. That's why I would say, and as I was discussing...
This is the Department of Defense is where I was reading.
Yeah,
this.
DOD. And then the IDF corroborates it, and it also tracks with the scale of the attack. This is a pretty substantial attack. I would say it's beyond anything the Russians have fired at a single target in Ukraine. Now, the Russians have fired 30 or 40 drones at a time, paired with ballistic missiles and cruise missiles at singular Ukrainian cities. They have never launched anything of this scale at a singular target, especially one the size of Israel. So in that case, the act by Iran is a little bit unprecedented. But at the same time, what happened to their counterattack was equally unprecedented. Not unpredicted, because I think a lot of commentators saw this coming. But as we know, what exactly happened to all those cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and drones that tried to hit Israel, Joe? How'd that work out for Iran?
I mean, we claim we shot them all down.
Be about 99% of it, yes. The only substantial impacts that I saw were down in Negev at Ramon Air Base, which is a fairly isolated F-35 base that in southern Israel. And I think there were only 5 or 6 impacts. Everything else was shot down. And I think only one person was hurt. I think a kid or something like that was injured by this. So the cost of the Iranian attack and its intent does not match up with the result.
Depends on what they were going for, right? I do have one question, though. I know this was Iran did this purportedly in response to an Israeli airstrike on an Iranian embassy in Damascus.
I wouldn't say purportedly. The Iranians themselves say that. All right, the Iranians, yeah, they give it. So, yeah, a week before last, the Israelis bombed the Iranian embassy in Damascus, killing, I think, over a dozen people. They claimed that there were two Quds Force, which is the Special Forces arm of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, elite branch of the Iranian military, in that embassy. So they said it was a valid target. That put the Iranians in a dilemma, because at that point, the Israelis were essentially upping the game. The escalation in Gaza was not developing to Israel's favor, to paraphrase Hirohito. And so when Netanyahu orders the bombing of this embassy, it flips the script, and it puts the onus on Iran now. Because now Iran can no longer just sit back and let the Palestinians eat these punches. Iran now has to react. They don't know whether or not the Israelis are purposefully goading them into a response, or if the Israelis believe there will not be an Iranian response, just like repeated other bombings of Iranian targets in Syria, and therefore the Israelis do not take the Iranians seriously. So the Iranians are put, they're given a choice by the Israelis. Do we counterattack, essentially, and play right into their game? But at the same time, we have to look strong to our own people. We cannot look weak. Or do we understand the Israelis are playing a game and trying to pull us into a war with them, and hopefully for them, potentially the United States? The Iranians chose the former. They chose that we are being provoked. We have to retaliate. The risk is less than the potential gain we have in this retaliation.
Yeah, we've seen this new brinksmanship game a lot. Mostly with Russia. Russia constantly was pushing the lines until they just straight up flagrantly pranced across it with their most recent invasion of Ukraine. But this like putting one toe over the line thing and testing somebody else's patience, this sort of probing has been happening a lot. And I think this could easily be seen in this. But also, as we talked about with the Israel episode, Israel-Hamas episode, Israel is no stranger to things flying into their atmosphere. They've been weathering rockets and shellings and other things from all of these different proxies. Most of them are supported by Iran, or sponsored by Iran might be a better phrase. But in this specific instance, I know that was a lot of stuff they expended. But I think they also, the initial attack from Hamas back in October kind of showed the capabilities and also the limitations of the Iron Dome system, the main air defense system. So that was a lot of good data for if you wanted to successfully attack something, right?
It was a different type of attack. Because the way Hamas has it, it's the perfect location for that kind of an attack. It's right next door to the Israelis. They can fire the rockets at a very low altitude and at a low trajectory so that it gets there faster and gives the Iron Dome less time to detect it.
Yeah, far more favorable.
It's far more favorable. Mm-hmm. Conversely, the Iranian attack had literally every single negative possible. It was far away. They had to loft the trajectories. They gave the Israelis a week of warning. Like they were spooling this attack up for 7 days, taking the drones out, fueling up the missiles, getting the launch sites prepared. The Israelis had been preparing for an exact attack like this for the last two decades, and the Iranians play right into their hands with this regard. And the Iranians end up, this is why I say, there's no way they intended this on being performative. It makes the Iranians look completely incompetent because they just expended 300 munitions, not cheap munitions outside of those Shaheds, which are meant to be cannon fodder and to draw fire. None of those small Shahed drones even got to Israel. They were all shot down over Iraq, Syria, and Jordan by the U.S. Air Force, the Jordanians, and the Israelis. So none of the chaff actually did its job. None of the missiles or the cruise missiles were actually hitting their targets. And so what it does instead is now it reveals, oh, this grand Ukrainian counterstroke they have, as you said, extremely strict limitations on their conventional power. They cannot reach out and touch Israel because Israel's 850 miles away from them. And they don't have the Navy, they don't have the Air Force, and they certainly don't have the expeditionary capability to actually reach out and touch the Israelis beyond proxy forces in Gaza, West Bank, and Lebanon. This is why when President Biden's on the phone with Netanyahu the night of the attack, he says, this is a win, take the win. What he's telling Netanyahu is, again, the script has now been rewritten. No one's talking right now about Palestinian kids getting hurt, not in the media. Everyone's talking about how incredible whiz-bang the Israeli air defense is and how ridiculous the Iranians look right now with this grand counterattack, which, 40 or 50 years ago would have made a lot of damage, wouldn't have had too much impact strategically because of the poor accuracy of the munitions, but it certainly would have sent a message. Now there's not even a message being sent except, wow, look how good your air defense tech is and how unquestionable your air superiority is. That's not a good look, especially if you're trying to look like the regional leader, a counter to the U.S.-led hegemony in the Middle East.
I mean, it's very compelling, but I don't know. Maybe it's the middle child in me. Maybe it's just playing devil's advocate. It's just, surely they had to know.
You give them too much credit. Hubris cuts both ways, right?
Like, it does. And they needed to clearly to maintain that strong face that they've been fronting. Like, what the last time we pulled a shenanigan like this, I feel like it was, we got Soleimani.
Right. And that is an Iranian demonstrative strike. Because what did the Iranians do?
It was chaotic, though. Like, it was not orchestrated at all. They were just taking pot shots at every American installation that they had ready access to.
Mm-mm-mm. Not quite, though. Think about the missile attack that happened against Al Asad Air Base in Iraq. Do you remember this?
Yeah, but wasn't that within days?
That was within a couple of days.
Yeah, it was all knee-jerk reaction-y.
No, they fired 9 ballistic missiles around the air base. They didn't actually hit the air base, and they called up the base and told the Americans, we're going to shoot missiles at you, before they actually fired missiles. So that all the Americans were able to get into scud bunkers, and people had a couple concussions. They got banged about. No one got seriously hurt or killed. That was a demonstrative strike, and that was against a base in northern Iraq, only about 80 to 100 miles from the Iranian border. That's a demonstrative strike. That's how you do it. You can show, we could have hurt you badly, but we chose not to. That is not what you get when you fire 300 weapons and only 5 of them get through and none of them do any significant damage, right? There's a huge difference in scale. There's a huge difference in investment, and there's a massive optics difference. That's why, like I said, this was absolutely not a performative strike. That is pure cope. Like, the Iranians were embarrassed on Sunday, absolutely embarrassed. And it's going to be even worse now, because if the Israelis do the unwise thing, which they're almost certainly going to do against U.S. advice, and bomb Iran inside Iran with the state of the Iranian air defense network and the state of Israeli suppression of air defense and tech, I don't think the Iranians are going to be able to shoot down a single aircraft. And so if the Israelis are then able to strike the Iranians within Iran, hit a target, doesn't even have to be a big one, and then leave, that's a 1-2 punch. You just expended your long-range conventional deterrent to no effect, and now you've just been counterstruck without any ability to hit back. Iran's rep has been set back 20-plus years. Like, all the work they've done with the Houthis, Hezbollah, Syria, building up this reputation of a implacable, clever, cunning, asymmetric opponent is getting absolutely sandblasted right now by some F-35s and air defense systems.
But it's just, it's so bad. I just can't accept.
It's so bad because it is so bad, man. Like, look at the Iranians, and how can the Iranians even move supplies to the Houthis? They have to seal small arms inside shipping containers and then accidentally drop them off the side of a ship sailing past Yemen. Like, more than half, 90% of the munitions they try to smuggle to anybody get interdicted by the U.S. Navy. They don't have any ability. They're just as trapped by the Straits of Hormuz as the other Arab Gulf states are. They have no Navy. They have no Air Force. They have a million-man conventional land army that they can't use because they can't deploy it outside their own borders because it would get annihilated by the U.S. Air Force. They're completely trapped. Their only friendly borders are with Armenia and Russia.
So you think, is this the end of Iran's bid for hegemony then?
I don't think it's
regional hegemony.
It's not the end. It's a massive setback. Because don't forget, as they shrink, this is a zero-sum game in the Middle East. As they shrink, the U.S. hegemony grows in relation. And the Arab states always have their fingers up in the air. The Arab states plus the Turks. And they're always trying to measure where the wind is going. And any inclination of, especially MBS and Saudi, any possibility...
What is that, MBS?
Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, de facto dictator of Saudi Arabia. He's been cozying up to the Israelis too with the Abraham Accords and all these other things. The Hamas attack on October 7th put that on ice a little bit. And you can tell he's vacillating, right? He's trying to say we support the Palestinians, but he also doesn't want to put these things because he also does not like the Iranians. And trust me, they are delighted to see the Persians get embarrassed like this. All the Arabs are. Absolutely every single one of them. Except maybe the Iraqis. But, and definitely not the Syrians. The Syrians are probably like, oh man, we are being backed by the wrong horse. It's going to cause a lot of recalculations. The only thing that could help the Iranians is if the Jordanian King Abdullah II is overthrown in an Arab Spring style thing. But again, I don't think so, because he's going to be reassured in his position again by the Israelis and by the Americans. So I don't think it's the end for the Iranians at all. I've said they've been severely weakened. The game is the Israelis to lose right now. It is seriously the Israelis to lose. If I was Netanyahu, I would absolutely take your winnings and walk and cease all operations in Gaza. You've attenuated. No. Yeah. You've attenuated Hamas down to, I think, a reasonable level. And with that kind of a slapping, to the Iranians, Hezbollah will also probably simmer down. And then you can, whatever, bring in the UN, bring in some kind of international peacekeeping force. But like I said, take this public relations victory and ride it. But they won't do that, most likely.
So, well, one thing to clarify here, just for the audience, because you called them Persians, because they are Persians.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think a lot of us get confused because it's just the Jewish state of Israel and really just a sea of Islamic nations, right? But if you don't really have to peel back the onion that far before you see that most of it, like you said, it is Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
Iran is the notable exception because Iran is actually Persian. It is culturally and ethnically different.
Yes, 100%.
And yeah,
linguistically, ethnically, culturally different.
And this is the same Persians that we talked about when we were talking about ancient Greece. It's literally just the remnants of the Persian Empire. In Roman times, they were the Parthians.
Yes, and then later the Sassanids.
And they were just very, very well known for being conquer resistant.
Mm-hmm. Fierce warrior people.
And that might be part of why that they stand alone in this sea of Arab. But when in 79, when they became the Grand Islamic Republic of Iran.
I think it's just the Islamic Republic.
Islamic Republic of Iran, and they elevated the Grand Ayatollah Khomeini. Ever since then, they've been trying to unite the Islamic peoples, specifically, in particular, the ones in their region, the ones that are all Arabic.
Yeah, and it's important to note, it's a uniting not so much under the Persian wing, but because of, hence in the name, they want to export their Islamic revolution. But their radical, neither East nor West is what Khomeini calls it in a famous speech. We are the communism is just as great a threat as Zionism and Americanism, right? We have to resist this with the full force of our ideology.
And I think that's an important just It's probably the important cocktail convo tip to pull out for this, because exactly as you were saying, Pete, like Iran has been very vocal, very active, and very hostile towards the West in this bid to set themselves up as a regional hegemon or just sort of a sovereign or regional leader. Like they try to speak on behalf of this part of the world, and that is a severe weakness for them, because as we've talked about, as I think we've talked about before, like cultural tensions very much play a role in not just in international relationships, but in strategies as well.
And religious tensions too. Don't forget, Iran is the only major Shiite Islam country.
And so it's not so far-fetched to think about this one instance completely upsetting all of the status quo of the region.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Like I said, this is a humiliating defeat.
It's just so. Oh.
It may help to actually couch this, because in terms of Iran's actual capabilities, it may actually help you to think of those missiles as fighter aircraft and bombers. All right. Imagine if they sent out a fighter and bomber raid and only 5 got to their target and none of them made it back home. All right. Like, think about that context.
Well, you know what else is bugging me, though? The whole Russia has now expended, what, 2 or 3 times over their entire military from what we understood, just at the rate of losses of tanks that have been reported?
No, it's not that steep yet. They have not. So in terms of active manpower at the beginning of the war, all right, reported, the Russians have expended 3 times as many men.
I'm talking about
munitions and in tank. So for tanks recorded losses, I think they've lost like 2,500 tanks so far. They were estimated to have over 10,000 plus in storage, and that was only what we could see on satellite. So they've only eaten through about 25% of their pre-war tank stocks, and then so on and so forth. People saying that they've lost 300-400%, you're underestimating what we had of them, because they're conflating the Russian active force, which was quite small in 2021-22, with their full reservist model plus mothballed equipment, of which the Russians have absolutely scods of because of the Soviet Union. The Iranians are not the Soviet Union. They've never been the Soviet Union, right? Like, they don't have that industrial base that the Russians had and still kind of have a little bit of.
Keep upsetting their oil money too.
And we keep saying they don't have cash. They're a freaking subsistence agriculture and petroeconomy. The Shahed is a marvel of engineering. It's a lawnmower with wings. It's a marvel because it's cheap, and the Iranians are able to make a lot of them quite efficiently. It's the same thing with the North Koreans. The North Koreans can make millions upon millions and millions of 152-millimeter artillery shells. That's because they have a fully mobilized, like, workforce, right? Like, everything they do is just work.
Yeah, but at the same time, the North Koreans have never successfully puppet-mastered a non-state actor network globally, or done the same stuff in terms of public diplomacy that Iran has been able to accomplish in spreading its unique brand of influence, not just in its region, but also internationally.
Precisely.
Very similar to what China has done. And for them to just blunder this hard,
it
makes my spidey sense tingle so hard. Like, are they setting it up for Israel to come at them directly so that they can pull some other sort of Like, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you're right.
When Sun Tzu says, appear weak when you are strong, he does not mean look like a blundering idiot when you're trying to hurt your enemy, right? I'm sure you would, I mean, as the Sun Tzu translator in the podcast, you would know that, right? Oh, yeah.
I don't know. What if they got missiles we don't know about?
Okay, let's see them use it. Remember, we don't know about it unless they don't use it.
Maybe this was just an elaborate, maybe they have figured out nukes. And this was an elaborate way.
No, this is the worst. No, that's the worst thing possible, Joe. Worst thing possible. Because yes, they might have a nuclear bomb. Okay, how are they going to deliver it?
That's what I'm saying.
You this, just saw this all them, their missiles this, get shot down.
That's what they were testing. They were like, will any of these delivery platforms actually be viable?
Yeah, or that's not a good look.
Or do we need to smuggle it continentally?
Either strap it to a camel and send it to the empty quarter, or maybe put it on a ship and hope the U.S. Navy doesn't have these nifty things called Geiger counters where they're checking out your illegal cargo in the Gulf of Aden. There's all sorts of things that are drawn from this. Every single conclusion makes Tehran look terrible, absolutely terrible, and not in control of anything. Like, notwithstanding the massive amount of American financial and material support behind Israel, but a country of 88 million, Iran, the Persian Empire, just got punked out by a country of less than 7 million.
Okay, but that's not the first time. That's not the first time the Persian Empire has been punked out by a bunch of hillbillies in the mountains.
This is not Thermopylae. This is not Thermopylae, man. But it does actually go to say, like, geography. That's what it seems to be their absolute weakness, man. The vagaries and the tyranny of distance.
You know,
also combined arms operations. They don't do good with that either.
When Xerxes III was trying to invade in retribution for his father and
talking about the Hellespont? The Hellespont
washed his pontoon bridge away.
Yes.
He had it last.
I love it. Yeah. He had them whip the water. Yeah. And then I think they also had to heat up red hot branding irons, and he had them brand it as well as like a punishment. Absolutely. I don't know how much that's actually Greek propaganda or what the Persians actually did. It certainly is a great story, though.
It's written down now, so.
Yeah. Thank you, Herodotus. Yep, so that's the counterstrike. And I'm sure we'll be doing another episode probably in a week and a half or 2 weeks saying, why on earth did the Israelis bomb them? Everything was going so well for them. But
you really think the Israelis are going to try and do something else on this?
I think it's highly likely. I think Netanyahu still feels like he's on the clock. And I also think he sees his window of hitting the Iranians and weakening them further is shrinking. And I also think that the hubris cuts both ways. I think the Iranians were very overweening and arrogant in thinking they could reach out and hit the Israelis like that and actually do something. And I think the Israelis now are feeling a little invulnerable because of the tremendous success of this attack. And they may go and they may overextend themselves a little bit in return. But we'll see. Again, that's worst case scenario. Because like, if the Israelis go and hit the Iranians, again, it changes the narrative. Now the Israelis are the aggressors again. Right now the Iranians are the aggressors and the Israelis are the poor, helpless defenders who did a wonderful job defending themselves.
So is this the start of strategic dividends that the U.S. is seeing? In the context of our Hamas-Israel episode, we talked a lot about how any conflict in the world today, just pick one at random, and it's probably Great Britain's fault, and now the U.S. bears the ownership of it, right? So echoing back to that, where the U.S. has ended up sponsoring Israel over the last 70-odd years, part of the reason we were doing that was because we were trying to maintain some sort of democratic influence in the region, and Israel happened to help us destabilize everybody else enough to make sure that not everybody would end up being communist because they were too busy, well, frankly, hating Israel. First Iraq collapses with our help.
Yes. I was about to say that we caused them to collapse, but yes.
And then the Arab Spring upsets most of all of the North African states.
Mm-hmm.
Just general
and
mass
Syria,
upheaval.
Don't forget. The civil war in Syria still hasn't ended.
I was getting there. And then the whole ISIS thing, that pretty much left just Iran on the map as an active, interested, vested player in supporting and promoting and spreading anti-Western, anti-democratic ideals. And Israel has, with again, a little help in U.S. sponsorship and weaponry, has pretty much shown them up. Like, Stuxnet We need to
a neat little virus.
Yeah,
we need to have a cyber freaking war
episode. Let's get Josh on for that one. Josh is really good at this stuff. But yeah, so like when we sabotage, when we helped Israel sabotage their nuke program with Stuxnet back in the day.
Yep.
That was pretty embarrassing for them, but it was also very, very limited. And now their conventional assets have also been shown up.
Yes.
Very, very dramatically.
I think it's important
unless
to note,
that's what
too,
they
that...
want us to think.
And I think it's important to note that the United States and the Israelis have sharply diverging strategic outlooks on Iran that are getting worse and worse by the day, because the U.S. is very content with containing the Iranians and not provoking anything that might shut the Straits of Hormuz and disrupt the world petrol supply. The Israelis they don't give a hoot about the Strait of Hormuz because that doesn't directly affect them. They can get their energy from the Mediterranean. They're concerned about Iran existentially. They are, obviously, because if you listen to Netanyahu or any of the other guys in the Likud block, if the Iranians get the nuclear weapon that they obviously want to get, otherwise they wouldn't be spinning up those centrifuges, they will want to use that nuclear weapon not for self-defense or deterrence, but to wipe Israel off the map. That's what they've been harping on. They've been saying that for two decades. So the Israelis want to destroy the Islamic Republic of Iran. They want to fracture it, maybe in a wonderful case, bring back the Shah. Regardless, they want to either regime change or neutralize the Iranians permanently. The Americans, especially since Iraq and Afghanistan, have no interest in going in to do regime change, especially not in an election year, especially one this hotly contested. So the concern is that the Israelis are trying to force the Americans' hand. If we can drag somehow and make the Iranians attack a U.S. asset, maybe the American public will demand to go into war with Iran, and that will suit our purposes very nicely. Because again, when you measure the Iranian conventional force, it would not do too well against Fifth Fleet by itself in Bahrain, let alone a fully spooled up American army a la 2003.
Well, we've also, in the last 4 years, have done a very, very good job of not deploying our military and minding our own military business.
Yeah. Well, we got Vietnam syndrome, right? Like it's becoming radioactive to put boots on the ground anywhere now. Anywhere. If we're not going to put them into Ukraine, right, which is in Europe, which is a place of vested strategic interest for the U.S., and we're not going to fully commit to putting boots on the ground in Taiwan, Middle East is a absolute far, far away third concern.
Yeah, it's I think it draws a point to the difference between a strategic interest and a strategic vital, right? A center of gravity.
Yep.
What we're willing to defend has changed, partly because I think we're seeing a resurgence. I think I've mentioned this previously, but I really do think we are starting to return to a pre-Cold War mentality where...
Mm-hmm.
American ideals come back in. I think ultimately we won't care about the multipolarity as long as everybody respects free trade. I think that's the main thing that will return to that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's, again, fine as long as we're uncontested on the blue water, right? As long as the U.S. Navy reigns supreme, everybody will be okay with free trade. Because they're not going to have a choice.
And that's why the main tension and competition is with China, because China is clearly building to contest blue water supremacy. And
correct.
And why would they do that? And they've made it very clear that they want to do that to shift things towards their advantage.
Yep. And that's also, again, tracks with the Chinese historical perspective of their place in the world. They're not going to be content to just sit back and let some foreign power rule their littoral. It's not how things work. So there we are, stuck again, right? Waiting for somebody else to make the move. The American Empire, right? It seems to have this predilection of not wanting to provoke because we know we can absorb the first blow. This is something Richard Betts writes about in his book, Surprise Attack. Right? Americans, Pearl Harbor, 9/11, the Lusitania, you name it. Americans historically have been very content to sit back and let another state take the strategic initiative. because we know because of distance and location, we can absorb that body blow. The Israelis have no such perspective because they do not have the strategic depth in any sense to be able to absorb such a blow. And so they've always been a believer in preemptive and preventative wars, always. Whereas Americans, preemptive wars, they tend to be pretty anathema, all right? 2003 Iraq, notwithstanding, arguably that was not preemptive, that was preventative too, but that's what the Israelis are up to. They're always thinking, they're trying to think 2-3 steps ahead. How can we prevent them from hurting us in the future, possibly? And right now, their number one geopolitical enemy made a misstep and now appears to be vulnerable. So they're going to seize that opportunity. It fits with the Israeli calculus.
I think one last thing that I would encourage folks to pay attention to is Iran is very well known for a network of non-state actors, violent extremist organizations that they support globally, predominantly in the Middle East, but also in Africa, both mostly the Sahel region, but also sub-Saharan Africa. And I think it'll be interesting to see what the ripple effect might be, because they have a very close relationship with Iran, but that's not the same as taking orders from them. And seeing this sort of paper tiger that this attack has apparently portrayed Iran as, I think it'll be really important to watch what happens with these non-state actors. Is this constellation going to dissipate? Is its supplies going to be upset? Are their teeth going to be pulled as they turn away from Iran? Or mm-hmm. What is going to happen here? I think that'll be interesting to watch. I also think that this must be a signal for a long-term U.S. withdrawal from the area. If this is the last of overt attempts for quite some time, because like you said, Iran doesn't have the money or the industrial capabilities to replace what they've expended. So I think this is going to have a whole lot of ripple effects, mainly for the U.S. and for areas where Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, Hezbollah, all of these different violent extremist organizations that were tied to Iran. It'll be very interesting to watch how this one event changes the strategic landscape.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. It does not feel like real life to me, Pete. It feels like there's no way you do something this big and this loud after you've seen the indestructible or the undefeatable hypersonic Kinzhal rocket get foofed by an air defense system that we've been updating software code for, but was originally from the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
After that happens, after it takes that massive volume of rockets fired from that close of a proximity at that low altitude to essentially significantly overcome the majority of the Iron Defense, Air Defense Platform's capabilities, like despite all of that, we're going to just spend everything we've got. Like, it just doesn't. It's like, did their lead strategist die when nobody was looking and they're like, we can never use him? Like, it makes no sense.
They didn't. So I'll be clear. I don't think they expended everything they had. They definitely fired off about 10% of their fueled and ready stock, which is a tremendous investment. Because you're not going to be able to tell me that they have more than 1,000 medium-range ballistic
missiles. And I guarantee you, for everything that's ready to fire, the two are probably in maintenance, possibly waiting on parts, getting reconfigured, or some other thing.
Uh-huh.
And so, like, that could very well have been the majority of the stock that they had that was ready to fire within the next 6 months.
Well, and it actually gets worse because the Shahab 3s, which are the medium-range missiles that they fired toward Israel, are liquid-fueled. Which is the liquid propellant in these rockets is highly corrosive and it can only be loaded up pretty much when they're ready to fire. You can't keep these things just hanging around because they will leak. And after you've loaded them to get them ready, it corrodes the absolute heck out of the fuel tanks. So these things have a relatively short shelf life, and you need to get, they need a lot of spin-up prep time to launch themselves. The Iranian, again, the vast majority of the Iranian missile fleet is short-ranged because they built it expecting to fight Iraq. Their stuff's just as old as ours is.
It's just... Well, I guess the one advantage being of the U.S. we have in this is that we have time to wait and see how this, how everything from this is going to unfold. It just seems so surreal for one of our adversaries that we have been concerned about for such a long time. This reminds me of when the Russian-Ukraine conflict like rapidly reached a stalemate.
Yes.
Like what? Like 6 months yep. in? And just the attrition rates of Russian soldiers vis-a-vis the Ukrainians just kept pouring out, and you're yep. just like,
and this was the army that we expected to hit Tallinn, Estonia in 24 hours. Yes, correct. It's right. Cognitive dissonance.
What were we?
Is everyone else, here's the thing, Jill, like, is everyone else that incompetent? Like, America's got serious issues, like, especially in its military, but is everyone else that utterly feckless that they can't conduct a simple operation like this?
Okay, but when we screw up a simple operation like Vietnam, we do it pretty spectacularly.
That's not a simple operation,
though.
Man. That's a war. That's a war. I'm talking about a single night.
It was supposed to just be a police action, like quickly round up some commies, send them
a
back.
You're comparing an apple to the whole orchard right now, my friend. The Germans could fire V2s at London and achieve better strategic, even tactical impact than what the Iranians were able to pull off last week. And that was almost 90 years ago.
It'll be interesting to see how everything shakes out from here. It was fun to cover a current event a little bit. Not as much analytical value that we're handing people, but, you know, it's flashy. Like the
I thought it was some valuable commentary.
I think so too. So a couple of episodes we got coming up are talking about force projection. That's a fun buzzword that will be a great topic, and that's the one we're going to talk about, that mobile pier that you were geeking out.
Yeah, where hasn't that thing arrived in Gaza yet? Like, when is that thing supposed to get there? They've been at sea for over a month.
Has it?
Yeah, it departed on March 12th.
I can't imagine it can float very fast.
No, there's no way, but does it seriously, a month to cross the Atlantic? Like, what is this? The Mayflower was faster than that, dude.
What was it? I really don't know.
I mean,
I know nothing about intercontinental travel.
You need to take my class next semester is what you need, man. Get yourself learning.
Yeah, so we got force projection. We've got people that need to like our content and subscribe or follow on Spotify, and we will compare apples and oranges, or U.S. infantry and other infantries, in an upcoming episode as well. And then, if you want to cover anything, just at Brass Tactics Cast. At brass.tactics.
That's right.
Brass Tacticast, I think, is the LinkedIn. No, it's not the LinkedIn. It's the X. That's what it is. Brass Tacticast is the X.
Yeah.
So thank you all for coming, and hopefully see you again or hear from us again in another week or so.
Yep. Bye, guys.
An IT one, but yeah.
IT1. Alrighty.
Bye.
Hey, guys.